Back to Liberty Commonwealth. So, the Commons Council has me be Martin Senior Assistant Attorney General Appellate Council.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Charles Hayden, and I represent Michael Rathmuller. I would like to reserve 5 minutes, if I may, for rebuttal.
All right.
The assignment of error in this case was that the trial court erred in denying Rathmuller's motion for a new sentencing hearing where the sentences imposed in 2009 were void ab initio because they purported to impose sentences for Class 6 felonies. They exceeded the statutory maximums for those offenses, thus entitling Rathmuller to a new sentencing hearing in accordance with the procedure mandated by this court in Rawls v. Commonwealth for all criminal defendants whose punishments have been fixed in violation of the statutorily prescribed range. In that Rawls case, the court noted a multiplicity of approaches to dealing with this problem of sentences in excess of the statutory maximum. And a half dozen different cases were reviewed in that case. And the court said that in Rawls, it was announcing a new rule designed to ensure that all criminal defendants whose punishments have been fixed in violation of the statutorily prescribed ranges are treated uniformly, and that this new rule applied to all criminal defendants whose punishments have been fixed in violation of the statutorily prescribed ranges. The rule did not make...
Okay, counsel. Rawls, as you know, was a jury trial.
Yes.
And that there's a distinction right there, but there's also would appear to be a good policy reason for the distinction, that you need to have a hearing because a judge can't really speculate about what a jury would have recommended. You don't have a jury trial here.
Well, it's certainly true that this case did not involve a jury trial, but I would note that the Rawls case did not exclude or make exceptions for defendants improperly sentenced by judges rather than
court,
juries.
The court didn't need to at the time because it was dealing with the jury. Now we're dealing with the judge. So why is it necessary to have a new hearing when it's a bench trial?
Well, because these were Class 6 felonies for both those offenses, and that's a statutory range, anywhere from 0 to 5 years. And we have to engage in speculation about what the sentence would have been but for improper sentence. All the cases that have cited Rawls' case since then, I found 7 cases that of either this court or the Court of Appeals citing Rawls' case to set aside statutorily excessive sentences. 6 of them were bench trials. 6 of them were bench trials. Every single one of them, well, and only in one case, the Hines case, did the Court of Appeals say, well, we're not going to require a new sentencing hearing despite Rawls. And they said that was because in the Hines case, there was a mandatory 3-year sentence. The judge imposed a 10-year sentence in that state. In that case, the Hines case, the statutory mandatory sentence was 3 years. And so it was pointless and a waste of judicial resources to order a new sentencing hearing in that case. And they said, subject to that narrow exception, where there's no question what the sentence is that the judge has to impose, we aren't going to require a new sentencing hearing in that case. But in other cases, such as the Burrell case and the Gordon case, Burrell is 283 Virginia 474, and that was a bench trial. And in that case, this court noted that it was not going to engage in speculation about what the trial court was likely to impose or would have imposed. It just orders a new sentencing hearing in a bench trial, not a jury trial.
And because that case, the Burrell, they didn't exactly say hearing. It just said for a new sentencing, entry of new sentencing order.
Well, I did not note that difference.
But you're right that they did talk about the, we're not going to speculate.
I also note in the case of Gordon versus Commonwealth, the published case of the Court of Appeals, 61 Virginia App 682. That was a bench trial case where, in that case, the judge had imposed a class 6 felony, just like this case, had imposed a 10-year sentence, all suspended, and a 10-year sentence with 8 years and 6 months suspended. And so the Commonwealth argued in that case, just like they're arguing here, well, we know, we can tell what the judge was clearly wanted to impose what he thought was the maximum possible sentence for this offense. And so we just reduce it down to a 5-year suspended sentence on each charge and dispense with holding a new sentence. As the Court of Appeals correctly noted in that case, this is not a mandatory sentence. Like distinguished Hines, it's a Hines, there's just a single sentence that can be imposed, 3 years, a mandatory sentence. But in this case, it's a class 6 felony. There's a range of sentences that the court could impose, and we're not going to engage in speculation about what the trial court probably would have imposed.
Counselor, can I ask you a question? In this particular case, the judge, Judge Lerner, had also heard the case earlier. What if Judge Lerner was no longer available and a different judge had to hear the case? Would that not introduce speculation into the
issue? Yes, and in fact, he has retired in the meantime. That's not in the record. But
so would you have a different rule then for a case where the judge had heard the case previously as when he hadn't heard the case previously?
Well, there's certainly no basis in any case precedents of this court or the Court of Appeals to suggest that. But if the judge that sets aside the sentence is the same judge that imposed the original sentence, therefore we dispense with the procedure in Rawls. There's no case law at all suggesting that we don't have to hold a sentencing hearing if it's the same judge that was originally involved.
But isn't the case law that you just cited saying that if we don't find any place for speculation, then it's okay? And isn't that situation here where it was the same judge that tried him, the same? It wasn't a jury. There wasn't anything. There was just he just had the same evidence before him and entered a different order, a new order.
I would respectfully.
I mean, isn't speculation? Hasn't that been the cases that you're citing? The distinguishing feature, and certainly was did the basis for the Rawls decision.
In the Gordon case, they noted the fact that the judge, the trial court, did not state explicitly or otherwise that it intended to impose a maximum sentence for each of the two convictions of unlawful wounding a class 6 felony. They said, accordingly, we cannot agree with the Commonwealth's assertion that the trial court intended to impose what it perceived to be the maximum sentence allowed for unlawful wounding. Exactly as in that case, the Gordon case, in this case, the trial court did not state explicitly or otherwise that it intended to impose the maximum sentence possible. There was this assertion by the Commonwealth attorney at the hearing that, Judge, you don't need to hold a new sentencing hearing because this is a bench trial, and really we believe that the Rawls case only applies to jury trial cases. Of course, that's not what Rawls said, and in this case, the Commonwealth said, well, you know, it was clear the judge was trying to pose asserted. That there was an attempt to impose the maximum sentence or something to that effect. But the judge, he didn't agree with this statement. He didn't endorse it. He didn't deny it. It was not a proffer, as the Commonwealth characterizes it. It was simply an assertion. And a proffer is where you're making a proffer of somebody's prior testimony or evidence and for purposes of the evidence that's excluded on appeal. This is simply an assertion. There was no reason of the likely outcome, assertion of, well, we know that the judge probably felt that it was trying to impose a harsh sentence here. That's simply speculation on the part of the Commonwealth at that hearing. There was no need to challenge it or do it. All the defendant defense counsel had that hearing needed to do was note, Rawls doesn't make exceptions for bench trials. It doesn't make exceptions for, well, if you're the judge that previously heard, you don't have to hold a nuisance. It just, they noted correctly that Rawls said, this is a new procedure that's set forth for all cases. In the case that you're citing, the Dargan case, was one of the six cases cited by the Rawls case as one of the various other approaches that didn't endorse, and it said that this is a new procedure that's designed to provide for uniformity in sentencing for all defendants who are sentenced in excess of the statute. And it made no exceptions whatever for other situations. And so I think it's not correct at all to suggest that the trial court that there was no speculation or no element of speculation in this case, as the Attorney General suggested in their brief about what the sentence would have been, because neither the trial judge, the judge did not say, well, it's quite clear that I would impose such and such sentence. There's the procedure that's specified for the judge to employ when there's a sentence imposed in excess of the statutorily allowed maximum. You have a void sentence now. You have, according to this procedure in Rawls, in all cases, all defendants then proceed to vacate the sentencing order a new sentencing hearing. And that's, it's a very, very straightforward argument. I'm not going to, if there are no other questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
There are 3 minutes and 43 seconds.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Kathleen Martin on behalf of the Commonwealth. The trial court's ruling should be affirmed in this case because it was not an abuse of discretion. The case here is clearly distinguished from the Rawls decision for two reasons, which have been mentioned by the Court. First of all, factually, Rawls was tried and sentenced by a jury, and the defendant here entered guilty pleas, and so he was tried and sentenced by the judge. And that is a critical distinction because the other point in Rawls that was emphasized was that the court, the appellate court, could not speculate about what sentence the jury might have imposed. And so it could not simply just say, well, we can take off the excess time, that's fine, because there wasn't any way to know that that's what had been intended at the trial court level. And so that's a distinction that makes a difference here in this case. And the same thing in Burrell. The point was that there had been this plea agreement that allowed the court to come back later and change the felony to a misdemeanor. And the point that the court made was here that we don't know what the parties would have done in terms of this plea agreement if they'd known that the court could not do that. So again, we have that element of speculation that we do not have in this case.
Counsel, can I interrupt you 1 second? You've been talking about abuse of discretion, and certainly that's a standard you'd like us to use. But if, in fact, the language we used in Rawls is that this is a judgment that's void ab initio, is it an abuse of discretion for a court to enter an order that's based upon an order that's been void ab initio? Or is that a mistake of law?
Well, I think the language, you know, certainly the Commonwealth agrees that the original sentencing order on these two convictions was void. But the issue here is the court was faced with, what do I do about that? The motion was for a new sentencing hearing. And the court said, well, no, I can do this by corrective order. And so the abuse of discretion is, did the court abuse its discretion in making that particular decision? And so I think that it's not, if the court had said, well, I don't think the order is void, then that would be, that would be an abuse of discretion. I mean, you would be wrong on the law at that point based on the Rawls decision. But that's really not the issue that the court was faced with or that we're addressing here on this appeal. And I thought maybe somebody had a question. I didn't want to be accused of interrupting. Sorry. And the other thing about Rawls was that the jury had been told that the sentence could be between 5 and 40 years, and they gave it 25 years. And so then the trial court sort of on its own just said, well, I'm going to make the sentence 20 years because that's the max that he could have gotten at that time. And it was pointed out in the decision that there's no way to know whether the jury would have given him the 20 years or whether they would have, since they took 25 out of 40, would they have taken 10 out of 20? And it all comes down to speculation and trying to determine, you know, what might have been done. Now, in the Gordon case, which was a bench trial.
Excuse me for interrupting, but may I ask a question? Are
yes.
you asking us to limit Rawls then to jury sentences?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that. I think certainly that's a distinguishing factor and is something that the court should take into consideration. And that when you have a jury trial and a jury sentence, you know, that is a different kind of situation. But I do think that you could not, that it might be going too far to say that Rawls only applies to juries and would not ever apply to a bench trial where the judge has made a decision. And
Working to Justice Millett's question, then, would you say that if it should be limited then to just where it's the same judge, because there's no speculation, because the same sentencing judge is doing the resentencing, albeit without a hearing?
I don't think that the fact that it's the same judge might make that much of a difference. I think what would be important is whether or not you could tell in the original trial record why it was that the judge entered the sentence that he did. You know, if the judge said, well, I think this guy deserves the maximum sentence, I don't care what it is, it's 10 years, 50 years, he gets the maximum sentence, then if he gave him too much time and you come back and the maximum is maybe only 3 years, well, then I think you could make an argument that the judge would have just given him 3 years.
And counsel, we don't really even have to go that far, do we? I mean, could we not simply say, in the case of a jury trial, you do not have the discretion to not grant a hearing. If it wasn't a jury trial, you do have the discretion.
Right. I mean,
end of case.
Right. I mean,
do we have to go any farther than that?
That's another way to look at it, certainly. And I think that it could be done. I'm just saying that.
Let me ask you this, counsel. If you do that, what does that do to Rawls? Are we overruling Rawls? Are we limiting Rawls? What are you doing with it? Because the language in Rawls is pretty straightforward, it seems to me.
Well, I think that you would be limiting Rawls, certainly, to jury trials. And I think you would also be limiting Rawls to those situations where you would have to speculate about what might be done. And that's in the Gordon case, for example, in the Court of Appeals.
But it seems to me in Rawls, they looked at a lot of different kinds of cases and said, we're going to get rid of that. We're going to get rid of worrying about that. We're just going to say if a sentence was outside the limits, it's void ab initio, and you get a new hearing, period. What's wrong with that? It takes an extra 10 minutes, and it's an easy thing for a judge to do, and it seems like it would be very positive for the community to know what's going on and do it again. What's wrong with that?
Well, I think that if you just sort of, because then you get to a case like this, where if you look at sort of judicial economy, judicial efficiency, and you have, when the judge is
so it's going to take this judge 10 minutes to do this if we send it back, right?
Well, but he's having a hearing on the motion for the new sentencing. And the defendant hasn't really presented anything other than he had an excellent record in prison to say that there's anything different that's going to make this a different sentence.
Well, counsel, I hate to interrupt you, but the defendant argues that the pre-sentence report that was submitted at his original trial he cites many errors in it, and one of the reasons he argues for a new sentencing hearing is to present an appropriate pre-sentencing order. So if Rawls does apply, doesn't that also give him the opportunity to have a new pre-sentencing order? Report?
Right, well, I mean, he would. If what it comes down to really is that if this court believes that what you said in Rawls was that any case, any time, doesn't matter, you get a new sentencing hearing, well, then obviously the trial court was wrong here and the Commonwealth loses. But from the standpoint of trying to look at this in a practical way, that the problem with the pre-sentence report originally here was that they thought that they used subsection C of 18.2 374.3 as their primary offense, and really it should have been B, and so that made the defendant have a mandatory time of 5 years in prison. If you do away with the mandatory time, then according to the way the defendant reads the pre-sentence report, then instead of you know, the report is laid out, and you've got Section C over here, and that's mandatory time, and you've got Section B over here, and that's got some different time. And so he seems to think that because he didn't have any other kind of criminal record, that he would be, the basis for the sentencing guidelines would be like 1 day to 3 months. But the sentencing guidelines are discretionary. The trial court, in any circumstance, is not bound to follow those. And the trial court here, when the mandatory 5 years was the guidelines, said that he was exceeding the guidelines in the sentence that it imposed because of the egregiousness of the offenses. And so certainly the trial court, in any circumstance, even in a resentencing hearing, you know, could say, I don't have to give you 1 to 90 days. It is also apparent from looking at the pro se pleadings that the defendant filed with the court, which the court didn't rule on, really, but they're in the appendix. If you look at the letters he sent to the court and his motions and so forth and so on, that what he really wanted was a lesser sentence. He didn't care so much about having a hearing because he even talks about how, you know, you just give me an equitable reduction in the amount of time, I'll waive my hearing. I don't need to have a hearing. Just give me less time.
There are defendants that really want a hearing simply to ensure that, that a hearing has occurred. They all want a lesser sentence.
Well, but I mean, I think it's, in this particular instance, I mean, just, you know, just the language that he uses, that what he really, I mean, they all want a lesser sentence. And that's what he wanted. He seemed to think that, you know, he'd served 5 years, he should be able to get out right now. But that's just not the way it works, you know. If you commit these serious offenses, you have to pay the penalty.
Let me ask you a question. And I'm thinking about it, I think practically, but from a different angle. We said in Rawls that in the instance where a sentence imposed in violation of prescribed statutory range of punishment is given, that the sentence is void ab initio, right? And we're not trying to back away from that. The question is, what happens next? Well, if a sentence is void ab initio, then the defendant needs to be resentenced, right? The court's got to impose a new sentence on the defendant,
right? The court has to do a new sentence, and what the court...
Okay, well, hold up a second.
Okay.
So the court's got to do a new sentence. Doesn't the defendant have the right to be present and an opportunity to be heard when their sentence is pronounced?
Well, the defendant was present. He was here for the motion. He was in court for the motion for resentencing. And so he was present. It's not a case where the court just did this on its own and entered a new order. The defendant was there when the motion for rehearing for resentencing was heard. And what the court said was that they didn't need to have another hearing. He could do it by corrective order, and the order says that it's amended to reflect the correct law and the court's true intention. And the court still gave the same active time of 10 years that it had given before. So this is not a situation where the court gave the defendant a more onerous sentence, which, you know, if it had been a situation where, you know, let's say the court had given him 5 years and they really should have given him 10, which happened in the Greer case, then the defendant was entitled to have a complete sentencing hearing where he could bring in whatever he wanted to because he's going to get a more onerous sentence. And that seemed to be the way the federal cases go as well.
Counsel, this case seems to really be, this is really one of policy. There's no clear statutory direction that you shall or you shall not. We can make a distinction with Rawls because that was a jury. But on the other hand, the language of Rawls would have to be narrowed, would have to be limited if we wanted to go in that direction. So this is one of those where we can go either way. What is the one policy reason that you would want to leave with us about why you shouldn't have a short sentencing hearing if your first sentence was void ab initio?
Based on the facts, the circumstances of this case, Your Honor, I would say that it comes down to judicial economy.
Okay.
That if the court can determine at this motion for resentencing what it thinks is appropriate to correct the sentence and the defendant is there, and at that opportunity, you know, certainly it just saves everyone time and effort if that is done at that time.
Now, your opponent, you're not going to have the opportunity to respond. I'm going to ask the same question of Mr. Hayden. And he's probably going to say, well, you have the constitutional right to, or you have a right under our system to be heard when you are sentenced. The same as the rhetorical question that Justice Goodwin asked. So if, on the one hand, you have the right to be heard when you're sentenced, on the other hand, we want to promote judicial economy, why should judicial economy trump your right to be heard?
Again, I think it comes down, and this case is very fact-specific,
mm-hmm.
That there may be cases where certainly I would want to take a different position. But under the facts of this case, where you have the same judge, where he's aware of whatever came out at the original sentencing, and he knew about the offenses, and for all of those reasons, in this situation, I believe that judicial economy would certainly be a factor that would take precedence.
Isn't the safety of the community also a concern? I mean, suppose the defendant had been sentenced to capital murder conviction, sentenced to death, and then there was also a burglary thrown in there, which exceeded the maximum for burglary. Why transport that person across the state for a hearing when the act of transporting him might endanger the deputies who are transporting him?
That's a factor that certainly could be considered.
But if the Commonwealth felt that way, they could just null pros the case. The person's got a death sentence.
That's really kind of outside the facts of
this
case.
But
it certainly is a factor in terms of you've got to transport the defendant.
I think that might argue in favor of the construct that Justice Mims seemed to be proposing, that for a non-jury trial it could perhaps be discretionary with the judge.
Never let it be said that the center chair has any privileges.
Well, you get a 6-1 vote.
Well, you can say it.
I don't know of any trial judge that would fail to say that sentencing people is one of the most difficult things that they have to do. I certainly say that. I remember it quite vividly from my term as a circuit court judge. My understanding of what a judge is supposed to do is to consider the circumstances at that discrete moment as they exist. And there's lots of different values that are at stake. Some is just pure raw punishment. Some is incapacitation. Some is restitution. Some is rehabilitation. But they're all a part of the societal response to deviance. And so it's a process that takes place at that moment with that person, with this offense, subject to a jury determination if that's there, and subject to mandatory penalties if they are also unfortunately there. I don't see anything in the Constitution of the United States about judicial efficiency. I don't see anything in there about it. Now, we have a lodestar that we'd like to run our courts in a timely manner, et cetera, et cetera. But I do see in the Constitution the protection for due process for individual defendants. And frankly, as far as I'm concerned, judicial efficiency does not trump due process in a situation where you're supposed to, as a trial judge, look at that person there at this moment in time and decide how you're going to impose a criminal sentence. So I suspect that you ought to have an opportunity to respond to that, because I am certain that he's going to embrace it.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that all of those things that you're talking about are really very important when a defendant is being sentenced for the very first time for the crime, because that's when the penalty is being assessed. Now, situation...
But 2 years goes by, 3 years, 4 years goes by, all of those things. Are you going to say that the circumstances that have now changed with regard to this defendant are immaterial, irrelevant?
Well, but the thing that changed, Your Honor, is that when he was originally sentenced, the court had used the wrong information in terms of what they thought the sentencing parameters were.
Well, that may be, but suppose during the period of time he's been in prison and he's assaulted 5 prison guards. Wouldn't the Commonwealth want to have that taken into consideration if, in fact, there was going to be a resentencing? Because they gave a really light suspension. You don't do that now, Judge. Now we know how dangerous this person is. Would that be legitimate?
Well, personally, Your Honor, I think that would not be a legitimate thing that could be done. But
I may disagree with that,
happen,
frankly, if there's a resentencing.
But I think, again, I think that if you just look at that this case is really much based on its facts, and I would ask that the judgment be affirmed because the trial court did not abuse its discretion under the facts that happened in this case.
All right.
Thank you.
Your Honor, the Commonwealth argues that this the judge is reviewed on an abuse of discretion standard, but where there is a common law rule, a new rule that applies to all defendants who have been sentenced in excess of the statutory minimum, that the court does not have the discretion to ignore that new rule that applies to all defendants. When it ignores the common law rule that is applicable, it makes, by definition, an abuse of discretion, an error of law that is an abuse of discretion, and therefore is reversible. The distinction that the Commonwealth asked us to draw in this case is, oh, well, we don't really need to do a new sentencing hearing in the case of bench trials because, well, it's just easier to just simply let the judge enter a corrective order. But what the court said in Rawls was that the order is void ab initio. It's a complete nullity that may be impeached directly or collaterally by all persons anywhere, at any time, or in any manner. It's that this court said in the Burrell case, 283 Virginia 474, that was applying the Rawls case. And so what the court did in this case was enter a corrective order. A corrective order to an order that's already void ab initio? They can't enter a corrective order to an order that is a nullity. It has to enter a completely new order, and that means it needs to have a new sentencing proceeding as well. I also note that the Commonwealth's position, that what they're arguing, they're saying, where we have a uniform standard now that's very clear and we don't have the multifarious approaches to this problem, they're saying, let's reintroduce some ambiguity and differences. Now, their approach, they're saying, don't do it in the case of bench trials. We don't have to have a new sentencing hearing. Well, that's not what the published case law of the Court of Appeals has indicated. The Court of Appeals noted in the case of Commonwealth versus Greer, 63 Virginia App 564, 2014 case, it noted the sweeping, very broad language of Rawls, and it said that in all the cases we have to order a new sentencing hearing. They did say, in Hines, though, we refined the Supreme Court's holding in Rawls as it applies to cases in which only a single mandatory sentence is available, like the 3-year sentence in that case. But in all other cases, we have to hold a new sentencing hearing. They didn't draw a distinction in those cases of, well, in bench trials, we don't have to hold a new hearing. It just applies to jury trials. And as I noted, there are seven cases that cite the Rawls case in reversing a sentence that was in excess of the statutory minimum. Six of those cases were bench trials, and in all those cases, they ordered new sentence. So this now, admittedly, three of those were unpublished cases, but in the published case of Commonwealth versus Gordon and Burrell versus Commonwealth, the court noted the sweeping language of the Rawls case, and said we need the, even in the case of bench trials, order a new sentencing. Thank you.
Thank you. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All rise.